Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am your host for this week, along with Jason Hendricks, who's going to be joining me in the second half of the show. But Breaking Banks, of course, is the number one fintech podcast and radio show globally, with over 6.5 million listeners in 180 countries. Thanks for joining us again this week. This week, we're sponsored by our friends at MX. Of course, you guys know MX did their digital banking week recently. We're going to have Jane Barrett, their chief advocacy officer, on in the second half of the show, talking with Jason about some of the stuff that's happening there and what is a chief advocacy officer. Some good radio there. First up, we have Bianca Lopez, the host of a new show called Be In The Know, and the founder of a startup called Tail, along with the co-founder and the CEO of a company called Digital Asset Corporation, and that is Yuval Ruz. He's the chief executive over there. But before we get to that, some of the news. We have Deutsche Bank in the news again for trying to simplify their tech operations with a new division. NatWest is trialing a biometric credit card. Robinhood is back in the news, re-releasing their savings product. You might recall there was a lot of fuss over their attempt to launch a savings account in the US fairly recently. But that might be the new announcement might also be timed to be associated with their hires they did back in September, where they added an ex-SEC official to the board after they'd faced some of those regulatory issues associated with their announcements. So good to see them having another shot at that. Our firm rolls out a virtual card for checkout loans. So it's sort of like a digital credit card, but it isn't, punishing in terms of interest rates. Pretty attractive interest rates in respect to these loans. So definitely not payday, but basically they say you can shop at virtually any store and split your payments over time. So they're integrated already with 3,000 merchants across the US. So some good developments there for those guys. And that's it for the news. Coming up in the conference side of things, don't forget we have Money 2020, 27th to 30th of October in Las Vegas, USA. And then coming up in November 11th to 13th, we have at Printworks London the Ultimate Global Fintech Festival, Fintech Talents, which Liz Lumley was talking about the other week on the show. So get along there if you want to check out some fintech goodness. All right. So while we're at Cyburst, we managed to catch up with Bianca Lopez and Yuval Ruz, and we had an interesting discussion about digital asset grids, distributed ledger technology, programming languages on top of blockchain and distributed ledger, and how blockchain might change things like health records and identity. And Bianca started off as an interviewee on this, but given she does her own interview show on the video cast, ended up helping me really be a co-host on this segment. So let's listen to an interview we recorded earlier at Cyburst. So joining me in the hot seat, we've got two guests this time. Bianca Lopez, the host of Be In The Know, and the founder of Tail.
Tail.
Yeah, sorry. We are Tail is the is your Twitter ID, right? And joining us from Digital Associates. Digital Assets, sorry.
He's tired. The man has it had is the 100
day.
Interviews.
Yes. Yuval, I'm sorry, what's your family name, Yuval?
Ruz,
that's cool.
Like
all right, so first of all, I'll come back to you, Bianca, and give us an update on your very great streaming video show that you're doing. But Yuval, When, you know, there's a really interesting history around digital assets here. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but Inner Tribe in their early days produced what they call a digital asset grid. And that was sort of a precursor to what we think of as blockchain now and distributed ledger tech. But so I'm not sure if you're familiar with that history.
No, I am.
You are.
But that's not where the name came from.
No, I understand. But having said that, tell me about what does digital asset
We came from the blockchain space.
Okay.
And we've developed our own blockchain like everyone else.
Yes.
We also have a blockchain. And
is it on a particular flavor?
No, from the ground up.
From the ground up.
We build it ourselves.
So no relation to ETH or Ethereum or Quarter?
Unfortunately not. We're not that cool.
Hyperledger?
We're not that cool.
Yeah.
And we build our own modeling language. Actually what we realized as we were building our blockchain is that describing processes and businesses in a traditional way, even on centralized databases, is not an easy task.
No. Mm-hmm.
And then you introduce a distributed system underneath and suddenly it becomes even more complicated. So very early on, our version, quote unquote, of smart contracts was not just the automation of processes, but actually how can you describe businesses, complex businesses, in a very efficient manner. So
right.
When you're writing applications and business processes with our language, the developer never has to understand how a blockchain or a database works underneath. You only write the business logic. So CTO of Amazon said the future is that businesses will only write business processes.
Right.
And we really believe in that.
I find it very interesting that you just said blockchain and database, because I've actually done keynotes on blockchain where I've described them as an evolution of databases, right? And yet blockchain purists don't talk about it like that, right? Because they see it as something that new. But it's a more logical way to share information in a distributed format.
It's a logical way of putting context and permissioning and having your data reside in and not in completely different areas without siloing them.
Right.
So I think it's a transformational change when you look at processes or when you look at who has access or permissioning level. But I think what they haven't cracked yet fully is how is it truly interoperable so it's not the flavor of the month.
Well, so are you
when
guys,
it comes to a bank.
Yeah. So are you guys looking at the problem of transaction throughput? Everyone seems to be focused on that right now.
Yeah,
sharding
so
and tangles.
Some of the projects that we're working on is, for example, you're from Australia, so we're replacing...
Originally. I live in New York now, but...
We're replacing the entire clearing and settlement system of all Australian cash equities.
Wow.
Using our language. So we're already testing the system, and in March we're starting production testing with our partner there.
So what does that mean?
Sorry. Go ahead.
What does that mean in terms of, so you're
she
replacing?
She can't help being a host.
Help to ask questions. Sorry.
Ahead.
You talked about replacing the entire clearing and settlement mm-hmm. of a country.
Yeah.
These are composed with many different systems and processes that currently exist. So how are you bringing them on to your language and how does that work integration perspective or even change management?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We've been working on it for 2.5 years and we're only now going into production testing.
Now you can talk.
Yeah. And well, first of all, we're replacing the entire infrastructure from the ground up.
They're going to run concurrently.
So the production testing is going to run concurrently, and then one weekend a switch will turn
off. At some point in the near future, it's going to switch over.
Yeah.
And you're going to hold your breath for about 3 days, right?
I am going to hold your breath for quite a long time, yes. But the amazing thing is, and this is where I find the power of the technology, is that we're on time. Usually vendors, even with legacy technology, with these kind of projects are not on time. We're on time. The market is already testing the technology. And like I said, in March, we're already going into production testing. We did a study in the US to show that our technology can actually meet the throughput requirements of the US equity market.
Yep.
So we're talking about massive throughput. And some of the use cases that we're working on, throughput never comes up as a barrier.
Right,
entry.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so let me ask the question in a different way. Mm-hmm. What can you do with the digital asset blockchain and the other set of technologies you've got on top of that you can't do in a conventional setting today?
Yeah, so and I think that's a great question. So To be honest, so one of the things that we've done this year is actually separated our language from our blockchain. And the reason why we've done that is because we see a lot of value in actually digitizing your business. And then the question is, does a blockchain underneath adds additional value? And let me explain. At the end of the day, if you read Yuval Harari's book, he says the future
no
business
relationship.
Model.
No relation.
My twin brother.
Yeah, twin brother.
The business model of the future is data, right?
I mean,
Google figured that out before everyone, yeah. And everybody's now following that trend.
Bianca's skeptical.
I'm skeptical on a data monetization level of when it will come to the consumer, because the consumer won't care until it's truly part of their economic intake.
I'm not talking about the consumer necessarily.
You're talking about a business.
So if you look at financial services, their architecture is very focused on application, and data gets replicated, modified.
Right.
There's so many different versions of the same data.
But the best FIs in the future will be behavioral driven, location driven, instance driven.
What financial services are starting to understand is they sit on a massive infrastructure and on a massive network.
Yeah.
And you're starting to see, I mean, if you're looking at the LSC acquisition or merger with Refinity, they are looking at data as the business model. So when we think about DAML, which is our language, we think first of all...
DAML?
Yeah, digital asset modeling language.
Okay,
very creative.
Yeah.
We think about how do you transform and digitize your business, first of all. What are the data models that exist in your business? And what is the data governance that exists within your network? And then...
They're so far from even recognizing what their data models are supposed to be. And I think you're starting to see banks go through an arm race of a gold rush of thinking, somebody told me data was important, now I'm just going to gather it all.
Yeah, they don't even have data lakes. They don't have...
Well, they have a swamp.
I like that. I haven't heard that before.
You'd be surprised that some of them are actually tackling these problems in a very constructive, actually.
Oh, and I'm not saying that I don't believe that banks are tackling the data problem or understand the data problem, but for that to truly be implemented, it's not tomorrow. Because
they need to
re-engineer the way they even build services.
I'm not saying that anything is tomorrow, but I'm seeing the transformation. We have a lot of very interesting projects that are actually in progress with banks, but to be honest, also in the healthcare space, insurance space, government, starting both businesses, governments are starting to understand that if you start treating data as a first-class citizen, the applications that are built on top of it are way easier to develop. So if you think about fintechs today, they get it, right? They start from the data model.
Yeah.
They start from the data
model.
We
both run fintechs, by the way.
And then everything on top of that is services that you run about on data.
Correct.
And that's
or experiences, if you want to look at it.
And that's effectively what we're trying to do with DAML. We have examples of applications that very complex workflows and businesses that traditional software development shop would use tens of developers, we can achieve with 2 to 3 developers.
And how would this compare to Foam as a modeling language? Is that what you're trying to establish in terms of how much of the language, at least barrier, of building infrastructure, they're truly interchangeable, which is a problem with a lot of code today.
So one of the things that by the way, we were able to prove this multiple times. So first of all, our language can compile into Postgres, AWS Aurora, QLDB, Corda blockchain, Fabric blockchain, Sawtooth, VMware blockchain, and you can literally take the same application, zero code change, and run it on these different offerings and get the same functionality. So we just recently...
Hey, I wonder why someone hasn't done that before, actually. It makes a lot of sense, right?
Well, actually, they did. So if you remember when SQL databases existed, you were able to write a SQL application, and as a developer, you had to know the actual runtime environment. Microsoft created QDBC, which was virtualizing a SQL database and effectively normalizing the way you write SQL application. Yeah. That's exactly what we're doing with business workflows.
So you are a techie. You're a real techie. I can tell by just the way you explained that last sentence. So
I started as a software developer at Citadel.
A byte ripper.
And then moved into high frequency trading. And then moved into this.
High frequency trading. It wasn't Enron, was it? No, I'm just joking. No, but of course... flash crash, all of that was
flash
very
interesting.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
My company might have been mentioned there, yes.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So, Bianca, give us an update on what's happening with Be In The Know and with Tail.
We're pretty techie on Be In The Know.
You're pretty techie too?
Yeah.
Can you code? Can you Python?
Yeah, I can code. I have a PhD in data, so I would say I look at
you
data.
You have a PhD. That's something I never knew about you.
Yeah, I have a master's in math and a PhD
is great,
in data.
This is great radio. We learned something new about Bianca Lopez.
I don't look like it, but I do.
No, that's not, that's
the
not
industry,
what I'm
saying. The industry tends to be like, meh. But I think I fell in love with what Tail has been about is realizing.
I apologize if my surprise was...
I get it every day.
No, it's because I've known you for years and I didn't know that about you. So it's nothing to do with anything else.
I think this speaks volumes of you. You've asked me about a human question, not my credentials.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
We shouldn't flash our credentials around. But I come from that background and being the note for me was... honestly, a curiosity experiment. It was a digital show that I started with some of your advice, Brett, of saying we need to shed light in the industry of data, identity, and privacy standards, and what is interoperability. There's privacy standards and interoperability standards that don't talk to each other, and a lot of people are coming from a product side saying, my product is great, and I see a net impact negatively in the industry. You see banks buy, and I was the CIO of a biometric company, and I watch banks buy things they didn't know they were buying.
Mm.
And they didn't understand, as you said, the impact on the processes, on the procedures, but most importantly, on the value to the client. So Be In The Know is a weekly show where I get to know the person behind the identity and behind their credentials and why the hell did they get into this industry.
Yeah.
Some of them are software engineers like yourself. Some of them are mathematicians. Some of them are anthropologists or behaviorists, which is really cool. And that whole sort of process led me to realize, hey, there's an opportunity here. There's a lot of marketing out there and a lot of firms that are talking communications without understanding deeply the tech. And I think that becomes apparent when you come to events like this in Cyboss and hear CEOs of large banks think they have to be a knowledge expert in every single buzzword instead of remembering why they're there.
Why are they doing it? Yeah.
So at Tail, we work with large organizations in financial services and technology to try to help them, one, learn again. Learn what all this amazing, incredible things that he talked about. What is it for?
Yeah.
What is it really doing?
Funny that you say that. I was just on a panel and someone asked, so what's your advice with blockchain and smart contracts?
Yeah.
And I said, before you think about the technology, can you tell me what are the core values of your business? What are you trying to do? Who are your customers? And once you understand that, and again, go back to your data model, what are the processes?
Then you know this is what you need to pay attention to. Just like
then ask your technologies, your technologists, can this technology transform what I'm doing? And I think that one of the things that we kept on seeing in the blockchain world is, let's do a POC. It's a buzzword. We have to do something in blockchain. We had a joke early days, just put a blockchain on it and it's fixed, right?
Yeah.
And I think that what you're saying is spot on because, you know, businesses really needs to go back to
why
are you there exactly.
All right,
what
so
value do you service, right?
This is where your two worlds are going to collide right now, right? Because with digital assets and what you're doing with Tail and, you know, your expertise and identity, here's the big question I want you both to consider. There's a lot of debate around the social credit scoring system in China and facial recognition and so forth. But we know that in the West, particularly when we look at things like KYC, identity verification, anti-money laundering and so forth, we know identity is fundamentally broken. So is the solution to solving our identity problems the blockchain? A shared identity infrastructure amongst trusted actors?
You want to go first? From my perspective, it's what is the problem that you're trying to solve, right? So when we talk about the U.S., for
example... That we know who you are when you come to an
organization. Yeah, but let's take that as an example of when you go to the doctor in the U.S., you have to fill a booklet every time about your life and your health condition.
Family history, your mother's family,
exactly
history, your father's history.
So clearly they're sharing your basic information. Even just that small thing is going to create massive efficiency in the healthcare system and at least the patient experience.
Right.
But it should also result
in better care, right?
Correct. And so sharing your identity or your medical identity is clearly valuable. Now the question is, for that use case, clearly you don't want your medical identity to
end up in a pharmaceutical company or an Alexa to sell you some other drug
or your
you don't
employer.
Need.
Exactly. So there you need to be extremely careful. And some of the things that we think about with DAML a lot is, how do I do partial disclosure? How can I actually on demand make decisions about what information should be disclosed? We don't believe that, for example, with that, like if you look at the public blockchains that say, oh, just use encryption and everybody should have everything, would work for healthcare information, because encryption that
wouldn't it work for even human relationships? Not everybody knows everything about you. So I think the beauty that why I love data is that it allows you context. If you build the right processes and you understand what you're trying to do and changing that, frankly, I don't care if it's this blockchain or that that database. Is about what data can do to say, what am I getting for what you're giving me?
Yes.
And I think the financial industry has a role to play of a value exchange, right? Data is a vehicle to do that.
Yeah, but I'll take another use case. And if you're talking about, you know, who are your students in the high school and their phone number, maybe within that high school, it's fine that all that information is open and public. And that's kind of why I keep on saying, go back to what you're trying to do.
What you could do is you could create a website that has everyone's details on it and their face on the page, like a book of faces.
That would be a great idea. But I guess all I'm trying to say is, blockchain actually is a database and it's a distributed database.
Get into what is the consent permission? Is it centralized, decentralized, and sort of...
They're the different modalities.
I'm
so glad to have a practitioner in the space finally admit that blockchain is just evolution of database.
Whoever thinks that blockchain is business is, in my opinion, wrong. At the end of the day, we're talking
about... It's the same people that think that the platform is a business.
Yeah.
So a Cassandra database does multiple clusters that replicate themselves very fast, and nobody sends Cassandra as a business product. No, it's a technology product that replicates itself very fast. So I always think about a blockchain as a database that has a mechanism to share information through some kind of a governance model.
Yep.
That's it.
So Bianca, what do you think about the proposition then that actually the data systems that emerge, particularly as far as you may consider your own data as an individual, because you're one of the top fintech data people, right? Because I've always thought that we're probably going to emerge with two systems where there's certain pieces of data that we consider sacred to ourselves, sacrosanct, that we don't want to share with others. And there's another set of data that we view as a tradable asset, that I'm prepared to give this data up in return for some value. Is that too simplistic a view of the world?
I don't think it's simplistic. I think I would even go one step simpler before, is that the average person doesn't think about data. They don't think about what they're giving as tradable of value. Like the average person doesn't understand what Thor is or how Google AdWords work.
Right.
So I think that there is one step even before that, that it goes towards the literacy and that innovation theater that this industry has built. Right? The POC lend, as you said it, is as well one of my pet peeves, because they go into it without understanding the use cases. I fell in love with a shiny toy. Here's my shiny toys. And it becomes a petting zoo.
Yeah.
And that actually is an offense to the
fintech
purpose
petting
of technology. Technology is a tool, and we're trying to serve or do something with it. And I think that, I genuinely think people are going to care. The same way you started to care about money being something that you got a return or a risk on.
Right.
When data is monetized to the individual, maybe then they will care.
So, to overlay on that premise, facial recognition. China It's now underpinning payments. It's an extremely efficient system. It's also part of the social credit scoring system, but we've just had San Francisco said they're going to ban it. But, you know, using a signature and a physical driver's license to identify yourself in San Francisco is insane, right? Given the technology and the data we have about individuals yet. So is it possible for us to, you know, get closer to a consensus on what we should do with things like facial recognition?
So I'll take that question in sort of three comments sections that I think are too long for this podcast to go into. One is your relationship with the government. If you look at a country, what right. is that relationship of trust?
Right, whether you perceive them
right.
as a trustworthy
player. So I think it's a perception of what is rightfully mine versus what's not. Right. And are you here to protect me? And I think in China, you to my surprise and ignorance, when I spend time there, they were like, hey, they're protecting me from the bad
exactly.
guys, so
they
I don't
do
care.
Trust the government. Yeah.
And but you look at Denmark, they trust the government as well, but they also respect their privacy way too
yes.
much. And
yeah.
say you only have, as you said, the right to know this compartmentalized information is a yes or no partitioned and contextually driven. And then when you look at facial recognition as a tool, is an attribute. Is a data attribute that requires liveness, that requires the right type of storage, the right type of private keys associated with it, if you're going to do a traditional PKI model. And most importantly, it requires education on how are they each different, because China, you have three major technology players that are supported by the government
exactly.
and use wildly. So what you have is interoperability. That's why it works. It's me recognizing you.
Yeah.
Today, in the next Cyboss, hopefully he'll recognize
so
me, I'll recognize him.
Works.
So
yeah.
it's just, but that has that interoperability built into it. And I think that when you look at the West or other countries, even Adar for that matter, privacy wasn't built in design.
Yeah.
It was an afterthought. The regulatory team has no idea. And just like blockchain, the banks are terrified. They look at it and say, if I choose this, will I get fired? Where is the standard?
Yeah.
Has somebody else done it? And I think that's a bigger problem to tackle when it comes to, is it facial recognition, behavior
yeah.
recognition, voice recognition?
Fair enough. You agree?
I just don't see, and maybe I'm going to be judged as being crazy, I don't see a difference between facial recognition and your passport.
Yeah.
Right? Or your ID.
Yeah.
I agree.
I think that where the focus should be is all that facial recognition did is it made it easier to identify you, right? Like, how many police officers can you have walking in the street asking, who are you? ID. It takes time, right?
Yeah.
So it effectively took a process that we're all okay with, which is being identified, and just made it very easy to do. The question is, what do you then do with it? Because imagine,
who has the rights
yeah,
to do what
right
yes.
to do
with that? And I think that's
it.
Why I was saying ethical first.
No,
I 100%
agree with you. But theoretically speaking, remove facial recognition out of the picture and just say, now you have a country that is going to make their citizens' life a nightmare by going everywhere and asking, show me your ID.
Right.
It's effectively the same thing. So the question is, why do you use the show me your ID for? Is really where I think the world should focus.
It's really funny. You use that show me. There's a sci-fi series that my wife and I, Katie, we love. It's called Fringe. Have you ever watched it?
No.
I strongly recommend it.
Okay.
You'd love it. But they have an alternative universe. So there's two Earths. And in the Altiverse, their ID is called a show me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's
And I think
cool.
we live in a reality, like I have an 8-year-old, and like we live in a reality that they have multiple IDs
yeah.
and they have their Fortnite skins
yeah,
and they
exactly.
change it contextually
yeah. Yeah.
or based on who they're with. So I think you're totally right. It's just about what is the process? What are you trying to achieve? And technologies are great if we understood what you walk around a conference, and my biggest pet peeve today, probably other than some of the experience design, is you don't know as a banker if you're genuinely having the humility, if you're buying apples, bananas, or fish. There's no sort of understanding or learning that goes on, and you get
it's
to these things like the blockchain
not, yeah.
where are you in that journey, right? Yeah.
And so you've then you might make a contact here, but you've got so much work to qualify it afterwards instead of something that could be better. And listen, guys, I want to wrap this up, so let's do this. First of all, Yuval, tell us how we can find out more about Digital Asset.
So you can go to just daml.com. At the end of the day, Digital Asset is the company.
Daml.com?
Daml.com.
Daml.
Yeah. And to be honest, what we're super excited about is the language and what can you do with the language.
Yep.
There's a lot of cool examples of the things that you can do there. And
get involved.
Join,
go code.
Yeah, join our Slack channel.
Very cool.
And yeah, engage.
And of course, Be in the Know is on LinkedIn.
Yeah. On LinkedIn with some pretty exciting plans probably ahead.
Absolutely.
That we won't spoil.
Let's put it out there. We're going to try and see if we can collaborate on some stuff.
Of
right?
course.
So whether it's Breaking Banks LATAM. With
we're definitely doing a lot of things in LATAM. With Tail being in Brazil, we're launching a few things.
Somewhere we're definitely
so
flexible.
Where you can find or try to get involved if this is curious to you is We're Tail.
Yep.
And my name is Bianca Lopez. And it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah, and Tail is T-A-L-L-E.
Exactly. And the two L's is not because I'm ESL, it's because we should all pause.
Very good. Well, that makes sense. And so we'll get that out on the Twitter feed, coinciding with the air date of this. And Bianca Lopez and Yuval Ruz, thank you very much for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thanks
awesome.
For having
Thanks
me,
for
Brad.
Having us.
Okay, guys, we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King, Jason Hendricks, and I will be back with you after the break.
This week's Breaking Banks podcast is brought to you by Privacy.com. Privacy.com lets you buy stuff online using a virtual credit card number instead of your real credit card. This protects your identity, protects you from fraud. Recently, I was able to use Privacy.com for an online purchase of some movie memorabilia from one of my favorite TV shows, Fringe. This was a site I really wasn't familiar with. I wasn't sure how they were going to handle my credit card information. I was a little bit uncertain, so I was able to use privacy.com to complete my transaction and protect my information. You don't have to worry about canceling subscriptions or trials if you use one of these temporary credit card numbers. You can set spending limits for yourself for each of these card numbers you set up or collectively. You don't have to worry about your card information getting hacked. That's the real beauty of this. So head to privacy.com/fintech. That is privacy.com, privacy.com/fintech. And as a special treat for Breaking Banks listeners, new customers signing up today will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Yep, that's free money to use on any online purchase where you use privacy.com. So check it out, privacy.com/fintech, and sign up today.
All of the software as a service tools available make life so much easier. But do you ever find yourself frustrated at just how much time you spend getting information in and out of one application into another one? And you're wasting hours every day moving data from emails to spreadsheets to the CRM and back out again. It's the kind of stuff you just expected to happen without lifting a finger. Well, Zapier can help. Fintech Forge and at Breaking Banks, we move a lot of data around, and Zapier is the easiest way we've found to automate the work we do. It connects all of our business software and handles the work for us so we can focus on the things that matter most, like producing content like this. So no more wasting your time on tasks that you know could be automated, because that's exactly what Zapier was built to do. Just go to our special link, Zapier, Zapier.com/fintech, and connect the apps you use most and let Zapier take it from there. Zapier lets you instantly engage with leads, send them to a CRM or a spreadsheet, anything you can imagine Zapier can help you automate. Right now, through November, try Zapier for free by going to our special link, Zapier.com/fintech. That's Zapier.com/fintech.
Hey guys, it's Britt King from Breaking Banks here. I wanted to introduce you to one of our new sponsors. They're a company called the Online Trading Academy. Now, let's be honest, most people weren't taught investments in school. Not unless you went to college and did specifically a finance degree or completed one of the specialist investment courses. And so you're probably looking at the stock market, seeing it blow up and saying, if I'd only got in 10 years ago, if I'd only done this. Now, if you want to be involved in the trading space, investing online, running that yourself, you have to figure out what are the mistakes that investors commonly make, how do I manage risk in my portfolio, how can I develop a second income, a wealth education plan for my family. That's the sort of framework that the Online Trading Academy will give you. Now, to kick this off, they offer special briefing sessions in person where you can do a free 3-hour introductory course to learn about these elements of trading and investing. You sign up for this free three-hour introductory class at otatrade.com/fintech. So they have free classes in your area. All you need to do is go along and register at otatrade.com/fintech. You'll even receive their professional insiders kit just for attending the program. That's otatrade.com/fintech.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
And you're back with Breaking Banks, the number one fintech radio show and podcast in the world. Coming up now is the interview Jason Henricks recorded earlier with MX's chief advocacy officer, Jane Barrett, a fellow Aussie. Let's hear what they had to say.
Excited to have Jane Barrett back from MX, one of the leaders within this digital transformation that rumor has it is taking over financial services and financial technology. And a lot of people know of MX because of the data they provide in the analytics and insights. Little known fact, they also hold some very cool in-person summits and topics, including one at Sundance, which, Jane, I would like to point out that for as long as we've known each other, I have never actually been invited to, well, any of your summits, let alone Sundance.
I'm sorry, Jason. I totally missed that last bit of what you said.
No. You heard me perfectly well. Not only have I not been invited, never been allowed to speak, not even, you know, the latest one you held, I thought was great and interesting twist because, well, Sundance is a phenomenal experience, not always accessible for everyone, but you held the first digital banking week in a virtual format. I thought that was really interesting. Tell the audience a little bit about how that event went down and who took place.
And maybe the public shaming will work. We would love to have you join us at some point, Jason. So thanks for calling that out. So for many years, MX has held fintech festivals or fintech data festivals at the Sundance Resort. It is one of the most beautiful places on earth. Usually just because of the capacity of the resort, it's for about 100 people. So, you know, not a huge scale, but incredible speakers, wonderful intimacy, great networking, you know, incredible experiences, whether it's summer and hiking or skiing in the winter. But what we've found is that as we bring in like these amazing speakers, it seems a shame that that doesn't scale. So Digital Banking Week was a way when we have all of these incredible speakers together to either record them on stage or record them separately and be able to bring their insights, their knowledge, their inspiration to a much broader group of people. So, you know, having Digital Banking Week going out to 10,000 people all around the world was really, I mean, such an incredible way to share the goodness of what's being created by MX at Sundance.
Well, and just to make sure we get this out there early and often, people can go, it's still accessible if they go to digitalbankingweek.com, right? Is that the correct URL they can find the content?
Correct, yes. So you can see videos of most of the speakers at this point, and you can download, you can watch at your own pace. It is such a great way. And I mean, I don't know if you've done it, but I will often dial into webinars or dial into live stream of conferences. As much as we all love a good conference, you actually have work to do and a job. So being able to watch this sort of content from your desk or from at home at night is such a gift. So we're super psyched to be able to bring this to the world.
Well, why don't we kick off? On day one, you had, you know, one of the leads was one of my favorites back to Boston days. We're coincidentally here in Boston, actually sharing it, where Dan Ariely started at MIT. What did Dan talk about from the stage?
So it's very hard to encapsulate Dan Ariely's sort of lifetime of work. I mean, even into his 45-minute talk, let alone down into a much more compressed version. But he really looked at, you know, sort of the fundamental pillars of his work are around, I mean, he has an awesome one with dishonesty. He has delved deeply into money. His latest book around Dollars and Cents really does show how people interact with money. But his real core body of work is around irrationality. So how do we as an industry really try to build in the fact that humans are not rational creatures, and sometimes the decisions we make with money are not in our best interests? You know, what can institutions do to be able to, you know, not only allow for that, but to enable people to still have great financial outcomes and, you know, healthy interactions with money while incorporating all of the weird nuances that humans have?
Dan and I got to know each other early in his journey on behavioral economics. We were having this discussion around why debit cards were on the rise in the early 2000s. Because as bankers, that's completely irrational, right? Why would you not take out a free loan? And one of the things we learned is it turns out most humans are actually pretty bad at accrual accounting. But as bankers, we always don't always think about that because we tend to be pretty good at that sort of thing. But it's that sort of irrationality that gets baked in on how consumers respond to things.
Yeah, I think the free loans is only good for the people who pay it off every month. And by far, most people, you know, well, half the country does not. I think he had a really interesting insight. He did say that, you know, banks could be more patriarchal, which didn't go down great with some of the audiences around the world. But I think if you could substitute that word maybe for matriarchal, because mom does want what's best for you. You know, the example was that, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a bank that you can only bank with them if you commit to saving 10% of your salary, right? So good for the bank, lower cost of deposits, great for the humans. You're going to build up a base of savings over your life. Like those sort of things, again, when you ask a person rationally that says, you know what, that actually sounds pretty good. If I know I've only got 90% of my money to live on, that you work to that. So I thought that was a really interesting insight around just some of the tactical things that banks and credit unions can do to help their customers.
I mean, it really strikes at the heart of, you know, for a lot of time, you know, banks broadly have stayed out of, oh, we don't want to have those matriarchal or patriarchal kind of, you know, the consumer should be able to decide themselves. But when you start delving into, you know, the realm of mission driven, mm-hmm. I think that opens up this broader idea that if the mission is, you know, somehow to do good, and that's aligned with someone who's opted into what your mission and vision are as an organization, it almost gives you permission to do that. And it brings me to one of my other frequent speakers, Neff Hudson from USAA. Curious, what insights did he share from the stage?
So USAA obviously is like, it's a 100-year-old mobile bank, let's just say. They, you know, when they set themselves up, it was and still is to support remote service members. So long before digital banking was a thing, they put systems in place and a mission in place to be able to truly help, you know, help the serve the people who serve us. And I think one of Neff's most interesting insights was that they use their mission as actually a way to resolve differences internally. And so if you have a disagreement, if you're trying to make a strategic decision, like the tiebreaker is always, how is this helping our member? And that is just such beautiful clarity because, you know, it's not about technology. It's not about this quarter's earnings. It's not about, you know, resource optimization or the org chart. It's all about the end customer. And that was something that came through loud and clear through many of our speakers across Digital Banking Week is like, how can you use data to truly support the, you know, financial health of your customers and members?
But, and why do you think that is? That if you look down the list of speakers, data came up quite a bit. Now, you are a data company, so there might be, you know, some predisposition there. But it really does feel like an interesting overlay of data and doing good and alignment to mission that really seemed to jump out when I looked at the agenda. Do you think there's something underlying that that's kind of tipped in the recent years around data and using it for the good of the customer?
Well, I mean, MX is a very mission-driven company. Our mission is empowering the world to be financially strong. So, you know, groups like USAA, who, you know, we have partnered with for a long time, obviously there's resonance amongst our organizations because of that shared mission. But there is also, you know, just from a tipping point, if you think of the way that data has been used to date, it usually is just to cross-sell, upsell, retain. It's
underwrite. Don't forget underwrite. Probably starts with
underwrite. I'm sorry.
It starts with underwrite.
but basically, it is monodirectional. We're going to take your data and we're going to use it to, you know, basically sell you more stuff. And I think there has been, and we, you know, we saw it a couple of weeks ago with the CEO roundtable and Jamie Dimon and a number of other CEOs coming out and saying, you know, there's a much broader moral imperative for us as businesses beyond the shareholder. And I think that those sorts of public declarations are very representative of the sort of conversations that we're hearing at MX from our customers and from our prospects around, you know, we are genuinely investing in the financial strength of our customers and members and, you know, using whatever tools we can to help them. And obviously that all starts with data.
Yeah. So interesting you brought up moral imperative because Adrienne Harris, who chairs the Financial Health Network, and for those who don't know, that is the organization formerly known as the Center for Financial Service Innovation is now Financial Health Network. So have broadened to think more widely about what their mission is. But her talk was literally titled A Moral Imperative Towards Data-Driven Financial Health. What were some of the highlights from her talk?
So Adrienne is such a wonderful speaker and she does not sugarcoat things. So she obviously knows all of the stats around the financial health of Americans and, you know, the low savings rate and the high, you know, debt rates. There is some serious issues that we need to address. And she really did, and as the Financial Health Network does as well, put out a very collaborative call to arms around how can we better engage customers to steer them away from predatory behavior, to be able to, you know, lower the cost of borrowing, to access, you know, for people who previously haven't had access to credit, whether it's individually or small business wise, to be able to service people better is everybody's job. And I think from a, you know, a call to arms for the industry, you know, she really represents the Financial Health Network and their mission extremely well.
Now, looking a little bit outside of the U.S., I understand Brad Limer was talking about a more global perspective as well as some lessons, you know, that could be brought back to the U.S. What did Brad highlight in terms of the amount of work he does, you know, in Asia in particular on lessons that he thinks we need to look at on a global basis?
I mean, Brad had some, again, some pretty eye-popping numbers around, you know, 22% of the world who are unbanked, right? 1.7 billion people. So that's less around, oh, great, we can go and get fees from 1.7 billion people, but how can we actually engage with them and meet them where they are? So calling attention to, you know, yes, technology can do even, you know, I love that, for some countries, they just completely skipped the desktop revolution and now all banking is mobile, or in fact, all digital communications is mobile. But having access to credit and making sure people can move money, You know, he really called out that the biggest opportunity is to be able to serve everyone and be able to treat people equally, regardless of background or race or gender or location. So he's you know, calling for sort of that next revolution in financial services is the idea of inclusion and in serving a diverse population.
Although I do want to pick on one thing that I worry about from our industry is a lot of times when we talk about inclusion, we talk about being able to lend to people who don't have access to credit today. And I worry that, you know, are we taking people down a path that isn't necessarily in, you know, their best choice for them? It's like kind of saying, you know, should everyone have access to fast food? I don't know if that's the right choice for, you know, the world at large.
Well, I mean, access, the credit model is, you know, a proven driver of growth, and responsible credit, if it means that you can now buy, you know, a goat and a fry pan, then that can be paid off at low interest rates in decent amount of times. Like, it's not that that person wouldn't be seeking credit because they may be getting it from, you know, the local loan sharks. So responsible credit as an alternative to what has been, you know, pretty widespread, you know, business of non-responsible lending. You know, and for small businesses especially, often the entry point for a new relationship in banking is a, you know, they're in a cash crunch. So rather than, again, go to a loan shark or a family member, if you can get a low-cost business loan from an institution that then becomes your partner moving forward, if that's the entry point, but it's a responsible entry point, then, you know, that is a good way in. But having tools alongside that, if it all it is a transactional loan, it's a huge missed opportunity. You know, you want institutions to be advocates for their customers. So that includes, how do you manage money long term? Are the families protected? You know, are they able to move, you know, move up the economic scale with the help of that institution?
Yeah. Now, are you familiar with the African approach to, I'm going to butcher how it's pronounced, but I believe it's a susu, in how it's almost like a club type of saving / lending platform. Have you heard of this before?
Not in that term, but the idea of pooling money, and whether it's for insurance or for credit, is again one of the oldest ways of working. I adore the Royal Neighbors of America. If you've ever dug into their story, it was basically a group of suffragettes who sold insurance to each other. They underwrote each other because women back in the late 1800s could not own property or earn money. So if anything happened to their source of income, their whole family was destitute. So that, as a way of you know, building communities, is a long established one. And if it can be bought at scale with technology backing, with, you know, proper underwriting, that's an awesome leap forward for communities.
It's interesting. We go back to community, and we'd started with NEF and talking about the community that USAA has built, and, you know, Susu's being a very local community in terms of a pot of money that you can borrow from and repay. Mm-hmm. And what you just described, you know, with the suffragettes, which I was not familiar with. So I love that. Did you have any other community banks from the States that had interesting mm-hmm. perspectives?
Yeah. So we had Stephanie Maxwell from Alaska, USA, which for all of the narrative that comes out of the financial centers, it is awesome to have a perspective from someone on the ground for whom, like, geographic challenges and economic challenges are so far out of the norm. Like, for Alaska, obviously a highly distributed population, highly seasonal income. So yeah, what they need to do to support their community, weirdly, is probably a good precursor for, you know, the gig economy. Right. So the lessons that you can learn from how to support a remote community who only gets, you know, really 6 months to earn a living a year, can actually translate really well for institutions and communities where people don't have the every 2 week salary. And that is one of the biggest hurdles for the entire financial services industry to overcome, because the world is built to pay your bills on time, even though your income may be, you know, highly irregular.
Have they made any investments in technology around that, around predictability and helping serve that in a unique way?
They have spent a lot in time, weirdly. They still do really support branches. They have invested a lot in interactive telemachines, so ITMs versus ATMs, to be able to support more remote communities. But they've also invested a lot in their call center. So they'll find, you know, someone's out on a rig in the middle of the ocean, they are going to call at 2 a.m. because that's when they can do their banking. So a 24/7 call center for an Alaskan credit union is pretty awesome.
Well, I did have an interesting conversation once with an Alaskan banker on the subject of physical security and the need to have a plan for bears. I thought that was one of my more interesting, you know, it certainly supports the need for a call center type strategy. You know, in all seriousness, though, when we think about the distribution and the changing model of how consumers will interact with us and how they interact with their money, that's pretty interesting that, you know, Alaska, America's last frontier, could be an interesting bellwether there.
Yeah, well, and I mean, they'd set up infrastructure as well that when there was the earthquake, I think it was 2 years ago, just even their power, the way that they'd set up their power grid and data center, they didn't lose a minute of service. They were up the entire time. So there, you know, some really interesting learnings from the far corners of the U.S.
So who said the most surprising thing from the stage that was new to you? Because you know so much about, you know, this space and this industry. Who gave you like a new nugget that either shocked you or you didn't know before?
So, I mean, everyone came with their nuggets, to be fair. and I think there wasn't, you know, not so much shocking, but I think what was really interesting was just the call to arms around investment, if that makes sense. We had Donna Wells, who's on the board of directors at Betterment. She was a founding CMO at Mint. She's known more about personal finance and digital platforms than, you know, all of us put together. So Donna was absolutely amazing in terms of taking the thought around investing in data-driven innovation and turning it into a strategic imperative versus what has been to date in many institutions. Investing in data and investing in software is almost seen as back office, right? It's infrastructure. It's something that's going to work with our core. And then, you know, she turned it completely around and had this incredible, again, call to arms that when you invest in data-driven platforms and you can, and she got very tactical around how do you pitch the board for these sorts of things. So for, especially for the bankers in the room to have that sort of insight from a board director herself around this is what I need to hear as a board director to really, you know, justify and then get excited about investing in these sort of innovations. Like that was, again, very refreshing to hear at a conference because usually you get to hear the day-to-day, here's the digital banking lead, here's the head of investment services. But to hear these messages from a board member was pretty great.
Well, and board members in particular can struggle, and maybe it isn't the board members, it's management teams we've experienced. When you're talking about these foundational investments, the business case doesn't always have a strong ROI. It's, as Donna said, it's this strategic imperative. It's something you just know you need to do. And, you know, outside of either some of the more exceedingly mission-driven focus or some of the larger that see it as, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Let's invest and see where it goes. That's a really hard thing, I think, for a lot of smaller institutions to get their head around.
I mean, smaller and larger institutions, especially when you have, you know, the specter of quarterly earnings over your head every 13 weeks, it's very easy to push this off to next quarter, to push it off to next year. And then, you know, it's something that Ryan Caldwell called out in his talk is actually, you know, if you have the infrastructure and the tools and the mindset and the mission in place for data-driven innovations, it actually doesn't matter how big your institution is. Size is less relevant. Yep. So I think that was a really interesting point to make, that this isn't just for smaller institutions to keep up. You know, bigger institutions are just as guilty as pushing things down the road.
Yeah, well, certainly agree on that there are, especially the larger ones that are under the scrutiny of Wall Street, can, you know, kick the can down the road, as you said, and smaller ones who might necessarily feel that they don't have enough that it's significant. They're only keeping up with the Joneses, that they don't invest in those things where they can really differentiate. You know, across the board, it is a really important challenge. What else did Ryan say about the future of MX? Is, you know, you're looking towards the next evolution of where MX goes. What else could Ryan share?
I mean, so it's the future of MX is fundamentally tied up in the future of banking. We, you know, truly believe that we are driving this, you know, the next generation of change within the industry. And I mean, you really only have to look broader into other industries, entertainment, travel, you know, transportation. Data has not just, you know, incrementally changed, it has brought exponential change to industry after industry after industry. Again, the blockbuster to Netflix idea, in that, you know, we're just going to learn from our customers and optimize and keep on optimizing versus just doing what we think and what we know is best for our customers. So this idea, you know, Ryan talks a lot about consumer obsession and almost like the virtuous circle or the flywheel of consumer obsession, is that when you have a great corpus of data, when you have gone through the effort of, you know, building a data journey for your own company where you've not just sort of collected it and thrown it over the wall to marketing to use, you know, to sell people more things, but you've truly analyzed what your customers are using and taken it to that next step, right? I mean, the very first step is often within institutions is the normalization, right? So taking the disparate data sets, normalizing them so you can have a holistic view of your customer, enhancing it out, analyzing to a point of, you know, how can we service our customers better, as well as what next products will be most used for them. But then taking it to the next two steps, which is presenting the insights that you have gleaned, right? It's not just about to teach the institution how to service better, but actually how to help people engage with their money better. And that is, you know, fundamental to our business, is the idea of enhancing data and then presenting it through a series of apps, whether it's a mobile app or digital money management tools, and encouraging people to actually act. So, you know, we've now got to the point where, you know, if you've got a Netflix model, they know how much I like, let's say, crime and thriller type genre, they will serve me up more of that and less of comedy, for example. You know, for institutions to get to that same sort of level of insight and presentation of that insight and advice, you know, it really is the future of where the industry is going. So we are, you know, engaging with institutions now with our latest product called Pulse, which are behavioral prompts based on both past activity, but also what's coming. Right? So, you know, I have a quarterly life insurance that takes me by surprise every quarter, right? To actually have my bank say, you know, your premium is due in 2 weeks' time, suggest you move money from your savings account into checking to pay for it. Like, that's the sort of thing that is, you know, totally doable now. But then moving into the future of, especially where we are with open banking, and I know we've had separate conversations on that, but, you know, we're now putting infrastructure in place as an industry where we can reduce data exhaust, where people are permissioning their data out in a much more, let's just say, transparent way. And then the opportunities for banks within that realm is absolutely huge. When you have more data being shared, you know, willingly for the good of my financial outcomes, like, that is where there's such huge opportunity for banks to step in with things like bot-to-bot negotiations. Like, there's so many things that we can learn from, but the future of banking, you know, we can say AI all we like, unless there is a great data set behind that AI tool, it's really not going to do much for you.
Yeah. Well, as we close out here, I want to go back to something that you said just a few minutes ago, that I think there's a beautiful symmetry between talking about a transactional view of a customer's data and therefore a transactional view of the customer versus a holistic view of their data and therefore a holistic view of that customer and relationship via their data. I think there's just something very powerful there that strikes at the heart of everything around being customer-centric, mission-driven, and the importance of data across the board. And so thanks for sharing the insights. If people are interested in seeing the source materials, I loved it. I haven't finished watching all 3 days. But if you go to digitalbankingweek.com or MX, that's mikexray.com, you can link to it there as well. There's a whole host of great content. And one of the things I love, it is not an advertorial. It very much was just great different material around these key concepts that you described. So thanks for joining us today, Jane.
Thank you, Jason.
That's it for this week's Breaking Banks. Hey, if you liked what you heard here, please take a moment and give us a 5-star rating at any of the platforms, whether it be, you know, Stitcher, or iTunes, or Google Play. We always love your feedback at Breaking Banks 1 on Twitter or info@provoke.fm. Maybe even more importantly, if you like some of these concepts, thought it was useful, take a second to share it with a friend. And again, don't forget, go to digitalbankingweek.com to see all of the wonderful talks that went on, put on by MX. It was a wonderful digital summit. That's it for this week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news.